This is Broadway to Brazil, the remarkable story of Corinthian Casuals, the English non-league club who took football to the world.
The footballing journeys taken by the Corinthian Casuals side are long and varied. From as far afield as Australia and Belgium, and featuring clubs right at the very top of the English game, the players have often seen it all before they walk through the gates at King George's Field. But they all have one thing in common. They've all fallen in love with this famous old club hidden away off a slip road on the A3. These are the stories of the men who make up the team today, the current crop.
In that changing room, there's no outsiders, there's no one on the outside, everyone's together, and I think that's kind of shown in the last few years, the way we've kind of ground out results.
He was going in the shower and he just paused. He turned around and came up to me. He's naked, effing and blinding. And I was just like, what the hell is going on?
He turned up wearing a Corinthians Paulista away shirt. And I had said to him, you've got to pose for me. And I think it got like 30,000 likes. Wow, this is bigger than just a little team that plays off the A3 in Tolworth.
Hello and welcome to episode 7 of this series of Broadway to Brazil. This episode, we're going to be looking at the current crop. To join me, I have my co-host, Dominic Bliss, as always. How are you doing, Dom?
All right, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Very well. And in the guest seat today, a present-day Corinthian Casuals legend, the volunteer behind the scenes that makes so much happen in terms of programmes, camera work, social media, Stuart Tree. How you doing, man?
Gosh, I'm honoured. Thank you very much.
Yeah, the introduction is about as complimentary as it gets. It's downhill from here.
Fair to say this is the pinnacle for you, isn't it, coming on this?
I'm surprised it's taken to season 2, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
Should have been season 1.
Your voice was in season 1.
It was, very briefly.
Dom, why don't you just talk about what we're going to be talking about today?
So we're going to be talking about some of the first team players in the current Corinthian Casuals team who play under James Bracken, including his brother Danny and Kieran Cadogan, the former Crystal Palace player. But in this part, we're going to be hearing from Rob Paratore and Ben Checklett, two people who have come from quite a distance to play for Corinthian Casuals, Australia and Belgium, respectively.
Yeah, I mean, just to tease our listeners a little bit, part of the motivation behind this episode was the realisation of how sort of diverse the squad was and how many sort of different nationalities and things like that kind of represented in there.
Yeah, I also don't think people understand a lot of the time the standard of non-league football. I think people often turn up thinking it's one step above Sunday League, when in actual fact the majority of these players were once in Premier League or Championship academies and have got Football League appearances behind them in some cases. The standard is very surprising, and this comes across in the people we're going to hear from today, because you're going to hear people who have played alongside international football stars when they were at youth level and, you know, being bollocked by Neil Warnock in the Crystal Palace dressing room.
Yeah.
You know, so these aren't what a lot of people who aren't initiated with non-league football would imagine to be, which is, you know, park football. This is serious footballers.
One of the reasons we wanted to get you on to this episode, Stu, is because you obviously have to interview these players as part of your work for the various Corinthian Casuals comms. I mean, have you really noticed that standard of player improving since James has been here? I mean, do you think that's a factor there?
Absolutely. James has said himself that every season he's had the best squad he's ever had here. So in 2015, when he came along, he brought his Sutton United reserve side that he was managing before along to the club, and they were fantastic. They had won every trophy there was to win at that level they were playing at, but it wasn't senior football. And so it was their first foray into senior football, and they really wanted something to prove. And we still have some of those players playing for us now, so I mean, it's testament to them that they've continued to rise to that level. Players like Kevan Saboni, for instance, have come through. Ben Checklett has come from that kind of level. And the likes of Jack Strange has also come along and proven everyone that, again, he's come from youth football under James and has really excelled to the point that he's, you know, arguably our best player. But James has added to that squad each year with quality, and you can't really pick a bad player out there now, certainly for the
limitations. It would be cool if we were to do so now.
Oh, well, yeah. I don't get me wrong, I can pick out some stinkers in the last 6 years.
Yes, let's not name them.
But, yeah, that's a discussion probably for the terraces rather than a podcast.
We'll put that on the Patreon.
Yes, our Patreon listeners can hear us slag off players. But in the meantime, let's get on with this episode.
Right, let's crack on with the first player we're going to hear from, and Rob Paratore. He's an interesting player in the current squad. He's a lawyer working for a commercial law firm, and that sounds like a throwback to the old school Thai Corinthians of yesteryear, you know, but actually his story's a unique one.
Yeah, I feel like you don't really expect an Aussie accent in a non-league British dressing room, but that's exactly what Casuals have got in the form of Paratore, and as the name implies, he's got a bit of Italian heritage in there as well. So let's start by hearing a little bit about his background growing up in Australia.
My father is an Italian-Australian, so he migrated to Australia when he was 5 years of age. So I grew up in Sydney. A part of Sydney, which is the St. George area, has quite a lot of European influence, a lot of former Yugoslavian nations there, Croatians, Serbians, Italians as well, Greeks. So football is definitely part of the community in that area of Sydney. So yeah, it started off obviously in grassroots football there, played since I was 5 years of age. Till I got to 14. At that stage, my manager at the time was bringing players over to Europe, mainly to England, and he thought that I was ready and that there was a few clubs that might be interested in taking me on board over in the UK, and Leicester ended up offering me a good deal. That was probably one of the best times kind of in my career. It was kind of at 16, like I was really progressing well, and Leicester acknowledged that, and I was getting pushed into the reserve team and youth team from like 15, 16 years of age. Ended up captaining the youth team there at Leicester and then progressed into the development squad, and then at kind of 19, 20, I ended up suffering a bad ankle injury, and I was out for about 8 months. At a time where I didn't have much time left on my current contract, so it was a really difficult time, obviously both physically and like kind of mentally.
So that ankle injury that Robert mentions was really, you know, a significant part of his career. It ended his time at Leicester. It meant that in spells at Fylde and Accrington, he couldn't really get a game. And at that point, he decided to try his luck in Italy, his father's ancestral home. He actually ended up in Sicily with Messina, once a Serie A club. And at that time, they were in the third tier. So let's hear about his time there.
It was an eye-opening experience. In terms of football, I learned a lot about football. As you see when you watch Serie A, like the game's a lot slower, mainly because it's hot. It's very hot in Italy in the summer, which means you can't sustain the intensity that you have in the UK. So the game's a lot slower, which means it's naturally it's a lot more technical and a lot more tactical as well. Some of the biggest differences I found. So typically in training in a professional team in the UK, you'd be lucky to do like 10, 15 minutes of that kind of tactical shape work out of like a 1.5 hour session. In Italy, it was completely different. So you could do 45 minutes, an hour of shape and tactics every single session. Some of the supporters are extremely volatile. Some of the ultras would bring in like dogs, pit bulls, and these kind of dogs into the game. And you'd be warming up on the sideline, and you have just like this flimsy gait in between you and this dog, just like ready to maul you down. Pretty scary at times. And I saw things like I saw players like have fights with ultras, like climbing fences to like try and fight. And I was just like what is going on? Like, these are actually like professional players. Some of these players, you know, had played in Serie B and Serie A, and they're dealing with ultras on this kind of level. Like, it's complete madness.
Yarick, did you say what it was like on the training field and in the dressing room compared with like the Premier League Academy setup he was used to?
Yeah, I was curious about that, and I actually asked him about that, about whether Corinthian Casuals was a bit of a culture shock having been used to these sort of professional level academies. But actually, he was really eager to highlight how the Corinthians have a sort of level of professionalism that kind of emulates that anyway.
The manager kind of has to kind of manage his players in respect of some players just simply cannot come to every single training, and he has to manage that. Before Christmas, it was extremely difficult because work was so hectic to try and make every single session, training session, and you have to kind of work around that by, you know, talking to players, trying to get from them what the input was of training, so you're on the same page on Saturdays, and just being quite professional in that respect to try and bridge that gap. Other than that, I think it's very similar, and I think most players at the club will get something out of the club what they would out of a professional club. The seriousness in what the manager wants to do and his intention to achieve that, it's parallel to any professional club. A lot of the players as well have ambitions of going on and playing at high levels, and they take their career extremely serious. You could go to another club, like 95% of the squad could go to our rivals and get paid for it, but we don't. We choose to go to Corinthians. And I think that just breeds this kind of amazing culture in the dressing room that people want to be there. We're in it together. We all buy into the same purpose. So the atmosphere within around training or, you know, in the dressing room is up there with some of the best I've been in.
Stu, that team spirit, camaraderie, these are words we hear a lot about James's dressing room.
Yeah, it's a common denominator for any of the players that I've interviewed. They all say about it's the most tightest unit that they've ever played in. They're all on kind of the same level. What you don't have in our changing room are money grabbers. So you've often got a lot of players in non-league who are only playing for a club because of the money. They have no other interest. And they'll be upfront about that as well. They'll have no other interest of playing for that football club other than to pick up a wage. And when the money that is being offered around is some of the sums that we hear, you can understand that. But with Corinthian Casuals, it's always been about everyone wants to be here because they want to play for this club. They want to play for James. And it is something that you don't see a lot of.
So next up, Dom, another player whose background has something of a international flavour.
That's right, yeah. Ben's story starts a long way from Tolworth as well. He actually grew up in a footballer's household, if you like, in Belgium, where he was born. He had family members who were professional players that he lived with. You know, he became such a talented player because he was playing with them as a kid all the time in the garden, and they were teaching him, you know, how to play. So shall we hear how he was first introduced to the game?
My mum, she had me really young, and she was by herself in Belgium. So she ended up moving into her auntie's house, and her auntie, two of her sons were professional footballers. So for like the first maybe 5-6 years of my life, I was literally around them too. Like, they just made me obsessed with football, I'll say.
What were their names?
Eric and Fabrice. My uncle Fabrice, he played like international for Congo. He played Champions League. I joined my first football club when I was 4 years old, and that was RWDM Molenbeek. They play in the Belgian First Division. I think I did 2 years there before I started playing a match. I remember my first game as well was ridiculous. Like, I didn't know what was going on. Like, I didn't know about positions and stuff. I was just running around chasing the ball. I think I was there for 2 years, and then I went to Anderlecht.
All right, so an interesting background there. What happened when he got to Anderlecht?
Well, he only played for Anderlecht for a little while, and that's when his mum moved to England with him when he was 11. So that was a really big change in his life. And it was actually really interesting to him explain how London's diversity helped him to settle in over here at quite a daunting time for him.
One big thing that helped me was the fact that it was so multicultural. So there were people from everywhere in my class, even in my school, even like just around my area, like people were from everywhere. Do you know what I mean? Whereas when I was in Belgium, like it was predominantly white players and I lived in a predominantly white area, you know. So I kind of stood out, which I didn't do a lot for my confidence. I think I didn't really like it. So when I came to England, the main thing that really helped me settle in, I think, is just everyone being so multicultural and just, you know, just everyone being way more accepting and just no one being so judgmental just because of the colour of my skin, you know.
So that's a perspective to Ben's life off the pitch. What about on the pitch here in England? How did he get on?
Yeah, so remember, he's still an 11-year-old boy adapting to life in a new country, speaking a new language. He actually admitted he had a bit of a crisis of confidence at that time in his life. He joined Fulham when he first arrived here, but he gave up playing football for a while very shortly after that because the struggles he was having with his confidence. And it was only when he was spotted playing for his school team that he was sort of urged to give it another go. And he was recommended to a Tootingham Mitcham youth coach called Paul White. And he said some really nice things about how he helped him fall in love with the game again. And this guy had sort of played a part in bringing through Mikhail Antonio at Tooting. He seems to have been a really reassuring figure in Ben's life.
Stu, do you see that a lot in terms of individual players maybe just taking so much from one mentor, one sort of, whether it be a coach or a senior player? Do you see much of that in the players you speak to?
Absolutely. One of the key things was James was instrumental in a lot of those players' development as youth players over at Sutton. where he gathered together kind of the best players from around the whole area in the 10 years that he was there. So he's known a lot of players from a young age, much like Ben when he was sort of 11 and then going through to a senior age. And then when he's brought them over here, they've all said and praised about how good James is in terms of player development, in terms of youth football.
Well, you know, James comes up in the next segment we got from Ben, actually, because once he regained his confidence and got back into football, he had spells in the youth ranks at a few London clubs, you know, including some professional ones. But a lot of ill-timed injuries didn't help, as he reached a sort of point where you'd normally be breaking into senior football as well. So it was really badly timed injuries. And that's when his sort of connection to Corinthian Casual starts to make sense, because he was about to meet James Bracken, who was reserve team manager at Sutton United at the time.
So 19 years old, I signed for James, played for Sutton United. We literally won every competition we played in that year. We won the quadruple. I think I was top goal scorer that year as well. I've got player of the year. I had about 6 appearances for the first team. And then, funnily enough, a team from Belgium came in for me called Virton. It was a second division club at the time. I had the option to either sign for Sutton United for a year or sign a 2-year deal at this Belgium team. I went out there for a week during that quadruple winning season. I went out there for a week and I ended up signing an agreement to say that I would sign at the end of the season so that I would finish the year with Sutton United and then I'd be there for the start of pre-season. So I signed that. I came back to England. We had 2 cup finals left and I ended up getting injured. I don't know, I did like a sprinting movement and I just ended up hearing a crack in my knee. And just my knee went instantly swollen. I didn't know what was going on.
It turned out that was quite a serious meniscus injury and it kept Ben out for 6 months. But the contract was already signed with this club, Virton. And so he moved there and he ended up playing a season and a half, but mainly for their under-23s side. The timing was really unfortunate because just as he reached a point where he was in the first team manager's thoughts, the Belgian Football Association decided to restructure the league. And the club's position meant that they couldn't retain their second division status. And it all fell apart, essentially, for him. And that proved to be Corinthian Casual's gain, because James had kept in touch with him in his time in Belgium, and Ben was ready to come back to London as well. And so the two naturally came back together.
And he told me he had a project, you know, he wanted to get promoted. He was bringing in, like, he brought in loads of players that I played with before. It was a no-brainer, really, for me. All I knew about this guy was that he just knew how to win. So even when I signed for Sutton United, I already knew who James was. I just knew that this guy used to just build teams to win. Like, it didn't matter how, but he just built teams to win. If we need to go long, we'll go long. If we need to play short possession, we'll play short possession. If we need a defensive block and counterattack, that's what we'll do. But we'll do whatever we need to do to win. And I remember that year I signed for him. Literally, I think we lost 3 games all season. Week in, week out, we were winning. And that's just what was expected. That became the norm. Just winning was just the minimum standard.
Stu, just pick it up on one of the things that Ben Trecklett said in that clip. He talks about the fact that James will just do whatever it takes to win. You know, it's not about we're an attacking team, a defensive team, a team that uses our physical strength. It's basically a bit of everything. I feel like most managers at this level have a distinctive style that they'll want to play, whereas I feel James is way more flexible and adaptable. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's very fair. The times that I've been in the changing rooms when he's given either a pre-match or a post-match team talk, you can tell that he will do what it takes to win that game out there. He will look at any game, and I mean any game, that they play with the fact that they can win it. There is no task too big. For instance, when we went to Brazil and Matt Howard was the manager at the time, and he was asked, what will the score be? Can you win this game? And he said, absolutely not. You know, this could be 27-0 if they wanted it to. If you ask that same question to James, and we went out to Brazil and played Corinthians, he would say, absolutely, we can win this game. Of course we can.
I love that.
Yeah. So that's his mentality.
Yeah. No, it's brilliant. And we're obviously benefiting from it as well. And it, as we say, it's a repeat theme in whenever we ask anyone involved with the club in the last few years, they all bring up what it's like to train under James and the winning mentality that James has brought to the club. And the other thing that, you know, we hear over and over again is that there's something special about the club itself, about Corinthian Casuals. And once again, Czechs was no different.
For me, the biggest thing I think that sets Corinthians apart from any other non-league club is the fans. The way the fans treat you, you'd think you're playing for a league club, honestly. Like, even our last game we played just before this lockdown, where they banned all the fans, and you saw literally just two fans like sitting on a metal container outside the stadium watching the game, sitting like singing their hearts out. And like when I watched the video back of the game, it sounds like there's a crowd there. Like when I was watching it with my friend, he thought that fans were allowed back in, and I told him no, that was literally just two guys sitting on top of a metal bunker just singing their hearts out. Like,
I wasn't at this metal container game, but I believe you two were. Stu, did you take the photos of the two lads atop the metal container?
I did, and actually at half time we tweeted out a photo of them from behind watching across the pitch. And it's just kind of one of those pictures that you'll look back now in the years to come and go, wow, do you remember those times when obviously all the games were behind closed doors? And it's going to be kind of one of those iconic pictures that you're going to see and go, this was what fans were having to do to actually watch their favourite team play.
It was Jack and Billy Stringer, wasn't it, from behind the goal? I think we should give them a shout out for
absolutely.
Their loyalty there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Jack was a star voice of season one, so absolutely we should shout them out.
Jack Smith and Billy Stringer.
That's the one.
Yeah.
That's the one.
And we've talked about one group of fans and their loyalty. It also brings us onto the Torcida Seething, the people that we sit with on the side of the pitch, handing Ben a Belgian flag after one game last season. And he sort of lit up when we gave it to him, and he immediately wanted to pose for a photo with it, didn't he, Stu? He was made up.
That was a lovely touch. He only insisted that he would pose with it if we had got a positive result. And
not
so,
a COVID result.
Not a positive COVID result, no. I said positive result because I couldn't remember if we drew or if we actually won.
I think that was the 5-4 win against Hendon.
You're right. Yeah, he said, if we win, I want to pose with the flag. That's the mentality of the players. If they lose, they don't want to be seen to be celebrating or cheering or whatnot. They take it very personally. But to win, he was straight over there, got the flag. It's lovely that all the nations are represented via flags by Torcida Seething. It makes for a lovely, colourful backdrop and really includes the players and makes them feel at home.
I actually asked him a bit about that. You know, does he still feel very much attached to his homeland and as much as he clearly loves London?
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. You know, the year 92 to 96 is like, in Belgium, we called it the golden generation because it was just four special years where all these players came out, just the Kevin De Bruynes and the Adnan Januzaj and the Witsels and the Hazard. It's like, I'm just very proud to be born in that era of where just loads of these great Belgian players came onto the scene. And I just think, yeah, I'm definitely, definitely still rooted to Belgium. Like, it's part of my identity. I think it's part of my style of football. I think it's in my everyday life. You know, my family is still over there. My mum still lives over there. My brothers. Like, my little brother plays for the young international Belgium team. So, yeah, I'm definitely very much Belgian still. In regards to the fans bringing the flag, that's another thing that I found really special. You know, that's why I had to take a picture, because for them to even know that I'm Belgian, you know, it's just special in itself. So, you know, when you wear the Corinthians badge, you're not just playing for any club. Do you know what I mean? You're playing for a club with a lot of history. It really brings a meaning to it. You know what I mean? When you wear the shirt, and you know, sometimes when, especially since we've been in this league, gone through probably a lot harder times than we've had to go through before. And I think that helps keep our spirits up, you know, is the fact that you are a Corinthian, you're playing for a badge that holds a lot of weight. You can't afford to disrespect it. Working hard is the least you expect. Even just the fact that we're so linked with Brazil, I think it makes everything better, you know. Like, I think it just adds so much passion and so much just, it just makes it so much more special, you know, because as everyone knows, like, Brazil is so known for football and just being a special, special country. And so for us to be so strongly linked with that and that spirit, yeah, it definitely makes for something special.
Stu, Ben referenced the Brazilian spirit there, something that you can certainly understand.
He's really bought into that. There was one game where he wasn't playing, but he turned up wearing a Corinthians Paulista away shirt or third kit. And I had said to him, you've got to pose for me wearing that shirt, because those fans in Brazil will go crazy for you. And he's a bit of a social media nut as well. So he was delighted to sort of pose, you know, thumbs up or whatever it was. And we posted it on Instagram and whatnot. And I think it got like 30,000 likes on Instagram. And he was just like made up with that. You know, it's one of those things that really hits home then to the players and go, wow, this is bigger than just a little team that plays off the A3 in Tolworth. Literally hundreds of thousands of fans behind us halfway across the world, which is incredible.
Right, so Robert Paratori and Ben Checklett there, part one of our current crop. Part two, Kieran Cadogan and Danny Bracken, two players who have covered perhaps a little less distance than our first two, but nonetheless, no less interesting. We'll see you there.
Hi, Dom here. We just wanted to remind you that the Broadway to Brazil book is available now. Published by Kingston University Press, the book tells the story of Series 1, in which we followed the club during a dramatic promotion campaign. We were there for the action, got to know the players and management who were performing miracles, and also delved into the incredible history of the Corinthian Casuals. Complemented by the wonderful photography of Stuart Tree, the book helps bring the podcast to life in a different way, and we think you'll really enjoy it. It's available from most major online book retailers, with more details on our website, broadwaytobrazil.com.
When I say those names, Stu, what sort of connotations come to your mind when you think about Kieran Cadogan and Danny Bracken?
Kieran Cadogan, fantastic. One of the probably leading lights of our current squad. Very honoured to kind of have him playing here. He's a wonderful talent. Danny Bracken, for anyone that loves casuals, I don't need to say anything. For those that don't know casuals so much, someone that's been around the club over 10 years, playing over 400 games, captain, leader, legend, is what the flag made by the fans behind the goal says.
In homage to the Chelsea flag, right?
Absolutely, yeah, I think so. But it's a nice touch for Dan. But yeah, what a not just a player, but what a person as well.
Yeah, the first voice you're going to hear is Kieran Cadogan. Really interesting story in terms of his footballing career, some of the clubs he's played for. But first, let's just hear about how he got into the game in the first place.
Anywhere I could kick a ball, whether it was outside or in my mum's hallway, anywhere, I'd literally break him, plant pots and everything. So went through all of that. She eventually put me into a Sunday league side local to me called Wonder Wanderers, just playing for enjoyment. And then it got serious very fast. I got scouted for Arsenal. I think I was like 7. Making the journeys to Highbury after school as a 7-year-old. So what's that, like year 2, 3? So it was quite a big strain on my parents getting to Highbury and coming back all the way back down to Wandsworth in South London.
So after brief spells with Arsenal, as you mentioned there, and Fulham as a youngster, he was back in Sunday League football at the age of 16, 17, and he decides to go for trials at more professional clubs at this stage. In the end, he got his break at Crystal Palace.
There's a lot of talent in Palace. You had the likes of Sean Scannell, Victor Moses, John Bostock, Wilfred Zaha, Nathaniel Klein, like the list is endless. But everyone was quite close, and it was a lovely club to be at. I obviously done well in the youth team and the reserve setup. I think one season I scored like 20 odd goals. So the next season, you know, you do pre-season with the first team. So we went on tour with the first team. We went to America and I was doing really well. I think the last pre-season game, the manager Neil Warnock come up to me and said, listen, you've earned yourself a pro contract. Just, you know, do well in this game and kick on, we'll get you prepared for the season. And then the last kick of that whistle in that game, tackle came in and I fractured my ankle. And I was like panicking, thinking, oh, he's going to take this away from me. But then he kept to his word and he offered me a pro. Got back fit again. And then, yeah, I featured in the first team that season, scored on my debut, played many more games in the first team to come.
I think it's interesting there, the side of Neil Warnock there, you know. It's a side of his character that he doesn't always get credit for, but you often hear from people who have worked with him these stories of like how warm he is towards the people that he works with and the players, and that he has this kind of family-orientated side to him.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair, but nonetheless, when he said the name Neil Warnock, the first question I had was, you know, did you ever receive a rocket from Neil Warnock? And how does a rocket from Neil Warnock compare to a rocket from James Bracken was kind of on the forefront of my mind. So I did ask him that, and this is what he had to say.
Well, I don't think James has hit the heights of Neil Warnock yet. I remember one from Neil Warnock. We played Southampton away. and I think it was like the 88th minute. I think it was 1-1 we were drawing, and I had the ball in the corner, and I started to do skills for my own enjoyment. I've lost the ball. They've countered on us, and they didn't score. But then after, in the change room, he was going in the shower, and he just paused. And he turned around, come up to me. He's naked, effing and blinding. I was like 18. And I was just like, what the hell is going on? And he was going crazy at me, saying, you don't do that when we're 2 minutes to go, blah, blah, blah. So I learnt my lesson there very fast. James hasn't been naked in front of me shouting or anything. So that's a good sight.
Shades of, was it Tony Pulis and James Beattie, the naked dressing room argument? Yeah, as soon as he said Neil Warnock was naked, I was like, hold on, I've heard another manager naked story. And yeah, I think it's Pulis, isn't it?
Yeah, Tony Pulis. And I think the story that went round was that he still had his cap on.
Right, yeah. Oh, the myth, the legend.
The myth. Stuart, I'm not saying that James has confronted anyone naked in the showers after a game, but has James got it in him to let loose at players after the games, do you know?
I've heard it firsthand. It certainly does. And actually, due to the shoddy nature of the clubhouse building...
I was just going to say, it's thin walls, isn't
there
it?
There are thin walls. And at half time, you can hear him at the top of his voice.
I think you genuinely have to be in the gents, don't you?
If you go to the gents,
you can overhear the team talk, basically.
Absolutely. You have to
That's
be in the
weird
gents.
That's a wind
fetish. But no, he has been known to be stern, shall we say, diplomatically, with players. A changing room is a testosterone-filled area, and when tensions are running high, I imagine most changing rooms get like that at some point. So James is no different.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, those manager personalities are important to a player, right? Who happens to be leading the club at any given time can really affect your career, especially as a young player. And this is really the case with Kieran. So Neil Warnock didn't stick around for too long, and then the change in management at Palace really ended up having an impact on Kieran's career.
Obviously, management changed quite a lot while I was there, actually, to be fair. The most I played was under George Burley, and he got let go, and then Dougie Freeman took over. Didn't really feature under Dougie, so I had the opportunity to go out on loan, where I went to Rotherham. That was a bit of a culture shock for me. I was up Sheffield, I was by myself for the first time. Didn't really handle it well. You know, I was quite like bored or just homesick. And that was a 6-month loan spell. Eventually came back, and then I wasn't in the plans. So I was told I could leave. And my agent at the time advised me, just leave and kickstart your career again. And then I ended up at Aldershot Town in League Two. You know, I loved it there as well. That was a good club. Unfortunately, the last game of the season, they got relegated. Pretty tough to deal with. And then again, a manager change, and he wanted to shake things up and change the whole team. And then I found myself at Barnet after that. The reason I went to Barnet was because Edgar Davids was the manager, and he was also a former player at Crystal Palace. So we had the connection from there. So he told me to come down. He's trying to build something. And of course, when Edgar Davids gives you the call, you kind of got to go.
That was a crazy story, wasn't it, when Edgar Davids went to Barnet?
I mean, it was crazy enough when Edgar Davids went to Spurs, never mind Barnet. Yeah. A crazy time. And actually, the other thing that I just wanted to pick up on from that clip was Kieran talking about his loan spell at Rotherham. He struggled a little bit with being homesick and that sort of thing. You often see young players, 18, 19, loaned out to other clubs elsewhere in the country. You never really think about the fact that that's, you know, a kid essentially uprooted and placed into a very random, in this instance, Rotherham, where Kieran has absolutely no sort of connections. And it just really struck me that how challenging that must be for some of those young players. From Barnet, he actually ended up having a loan spell in Sweden, of all places. So so let's hear how that came to pass.
Went down to Barnet, was playing. It was good, playing a lovely style of football. And again, he got sacked. Another manager came in, I think Martin Allen came in. The whole club just changed, you know. It wasn't really for me. Yeah, Barnet was in the conference at that time. And I was kind of thinking my style of football was not suited to conference at this time, where, you know, there's a lot of football in the air and booting it and heading it. And I'm more of a technical player who wants to get the ball to feet and play. And that wasn't the game after Edgar left. I was advised to seek other opportunities. And I ended up in playing in Sweden for a team called Geis in Gothenburg. Again, from my Rotherham experience, I was quite sceptical of going, as I'm a homeboy. So through all my life, I've just been me and my mum. And then to go to another country was a bit daunting. So I think initially it was proposed, like, just go for 2 months, see how you find it. And I went, and it was brilliant. I fell in love with the city, and I ended up staying there for another 2.5 years. It was great. I loved it. But towards the back end of that, I think I started to get homesick again. Staying regularly in contact with people that were in England, I always was drawn back to England. So eventually I came back to England. And then I remember a few clubs were after me. But then I watched that game. It was Sutton United v Arsenal in the FA Cup. Once I saw how Sutton was set up, I just thought I have to go to Sutton. And I knew quite a few players from previous as well, and they had a good team. So I was drawn there, and I ended up signing for Sutton. And it wasn't too far from home, so it worked out nicely.
There's that Sutton link again, and James's time as reserve team coach there. It's come up quite a lot, that.
I think James has a little black book, so to speak, that all managers have. And one of the key things in non-league football is you've got to have a good contacts book. Mm. And the Sutton link will certainly have helped in that sense. A lot of the players that we do get here will either have a Sutton United link or a Crystal Palace link, and due to our sort of manager and assistant manager. So there's no surprise that, you know, Kieran was involved at both Palace and Sutton, and that he's ended up here.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I actually put to him. I asked Kieran, what was the original link that brought him to the Casuals? And he explained who it was.
Nathaniel Pinney and Hakeem Madelikan were with me at Palace. I was without a club for a while, and they were telling me to come down. I didn't really have any previous knowledge. I watched the documentary of Corinthian Casuals going to Brazil, and I was like, oh, that looks so interesting. Then the boys called me saying, like, would you come down? I was like, yeah, sure, why not? Because at the time I was at Wildstone, and I wasn't getting into their team because they were absolutely flying, and I signed late. I just wanted to really play matches. They called me, so then, yeah, it was a no-brainer, so I just came down.
What were kind of your first impressions of Casuals? I mean, obviously you've been at professional teams like Crystal Palace, so when you're at Casuals, is it a bit of a shock with sort of the facilities and that sort of stuff? But then I guess you had already had a bit of non-league experience by this point.
Yeah, I had, but then again, I think just little things that I think the Casuals do that makes you feel like you're in a professional setup. The changing rooms are nice. You get fed after the game. They wash the kit. The stadium's nice. The pitch is nice. Some grounds I played at in non-league, the pitches have been borderline dangerous. Fans are rocking as well. That's just one thing I've got to say about the club. The fans are amazing. I've been at stadiums again in non-league where there's been 3 fans in the crowd. So to come and play in front of 500 plus, depending on the game, it's really good for the level. One thing I did check, I called around people that knew James or played under James. And one thing they all said is that he's a great coach. Like, training is always thorough. You know, it's not just come in, have a kick about, lads, play a match and go home. It's always got some kind of strategy, some kind of ethos to training that we can implement on a match day. Especially at non-league, you don't really get that a lot. So I thought that was a big, big tick for me. Where there's no wages, you would think that some teams, they'll kind of take anyone. But, you know, with James in control, he attracts good players. So he can literally decide who he wants and who he doesn't want, which I think is so much better for the club.
Some really lovely stuff about the club there from Kieran. I mean, low expectations that, you know, us feeding him and washing the kit was considered to be a bonus. But I think but generally the things he had to say about the club were brilliant there. Does that all help a club like ours, Stuart?
Yeah. One of the big things that James changed when he came in was to make the place a lot more professional. And he's really achieved that. He goes right down to the very minute details. He's listed out all the things that a player can expect to get as being part of this club. And that includes even things like, you know, nutritional drinks. And yeah, we laugh about clean kit and all that, but actually clean towels and clean things for after training sessions and whatnot as well. Just, yeah, you know, all laid out properly for them and everything. It's is a level of professionalism now than if I say 10 years ago, this was almost, I could almost say this club was a social club with a football team attached.
That's the last we'll hear from Kieran in this episode. But I did want to just give him a quick plug. He has a podcast of his own, On the Judy, and it's actually all about professional footballers that he's come across in his Palace days and other days. So the likes of Wilf Zaha, Sean Davis, Mikel Antonio, they've all appeared on there. So just a little plug for Kieran's podcast there, On the Judy, if you want to hear some pros sort of talking about their journey to date.
Well, let's move on to the next player we're going to feature and the last in our episode, which is Danny Bracken. Goalkeeper, captain, brother of the manager, beloved by Corinthian supporters in Tolworth and Sao Paulo. And he's represented this club in England, Brazil and Hungary. It's not bad, is it?
How many appearances did you say, Stu, Danny's racked up?
He is over 400 now. I think it's about 420 or so. And that's competitive.
I have to say, Danny is very generous with his time for the podcast. To start us off with Danny, let's just hear a little bit about his upbringing. He and James were brought up in a football mad family, and specifically a West Ham United mad family.
It started from when I was born. I didn't have a choice. West Ham supporter, West Ham bed, West Ham pyjamas, West Ham clothes. Football was always going to be a part of me. I guess I started playing football when we were like primary school, and my dad used to do the coaching, and my brother used to help him. Even from that age in primary school, my brother was my coach. So, you know, I've had experience with him coaching me for a lot of years now. Yeah, and obviously just played local football. I used to be an outfield player. Used to play on the left wing and used to really enjoy that. And got a little bit frustrated with the standard of our goalkeeper in our team, and I thought I could do a better job. So I decided to go in goal, and from there got trials with West Ham. I managed to get signed for the academy and was in the academy for 3 years, from under-12s to under-15s, and got released because I was too small. I wasn't able to play up at a year group because of the restructuring of the academy at that time. And I came out and joined Sutton United, where I played for my dad, who was in charge of the team at that time. Yeah, and then kind of just worked my way up from there, got into the youth team, got into some first team squads at 17, went off and thought I needed to be playing football rather than sitting on a bench. So I joined Tooting and Mitcham, and that's where kind of my senior football really started.
So there's the Sutton United link again. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you notice about Sutton, actually, they've just been promoted to League Two, is that in these stories, they come up as a sort of halfway point between professional and non-league football for a lot of players' stories. It seems to be the club they go to as they look to sort of find their level after leaving a major academy or something like that.
Yeah, they're a large enough side to be that, you're like you say, that kind of halfway house. They're a very well-established club in the local area, in a very populated area for footballers. It makes sense that a lot of players that are coming out of, so maybe professional or starting out even, that they would go through such a large club like Sutton United in terms of non-league, and actually now in the league, you know, that's how well they've done. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me that they produce a lot of talent.
Delighted to see them come up as well.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of Sutton United supporters come down and watch Corinthian Casuals, and so there's a real overlap of friendship between the two clubs.
Well, you're a Sutton boy yourself, right, Dom?
Well, yeah, I went to school in Sutton. I went to a lot of Sutton United games growing up, and I've got a real soft spot for the club. So I was really pleased that when we started this podcast, people who have their own sort of blog and fan-based media stuff for Sutton United called Gandemonium were some of the most supportive people for us. So it's really great that there is this link between the two clubs, not just on the pitch, but off it as well.
Brilliant. Going back to Danny, so he first arrived at Casual 11 years ago, and another factor in this is once again that same theme of a managerial change. So much like Kieran had managerial changes that cost him his place, Danny found something similar happening at Tooting Image.
Tooting, the manager retired, new manager came in, and to be honest, he just bought a goalie straight in and didn't even look at me. So then they said that they'd send me on loan. Played in a tournament at Casuals, a pre-season tournament, and the Casuals manager said that he kind of wanted me to come down. So I joined Casuals on loan in August 2010. Yeah, and I've been there ever since.
That's what brought you to Casuals, but what's kept you at Casuals over the years?
Loyalty. The tradition, the people. I've obviously played in front of lots and lots and lots of different non-league crowds, and our one's a special crowd. We can play absolutely rubbish and you still get clapped off the pitch. Yeah, it's a special place, but the people want you to do well and you want to do well for the people, and you don't. We're not obviously not there for the money. So if we can give them enjoyment and a sense of pride, yeah, that's what we do it for.
And I guess your brother being your manager probably helps as well on that front.
Yeah, of course it does. I was obviously at Casuals for 5-6 years before James joined. Maybe if James hadn't joined, it might have been slightly different. But James came in and the whole attitude towards what we could achieve as a club completely changed. Instead of us trying to fight relegation, we decided that we wanted to actually fight at the top of the league, and that's what we kind of did for the first few years and managed to get our promotion, which was an unbelievable achievement.
It's brilliant to hear him speak that way about the game, isn't it? It's pure passion, isn't it, Stu?
Yeah, completely. And it's kind of a rarer breed these days, just in football in general, to have that kind of loyalty. I think he realises now that he's got a legendary status here. It would be difficult for him to move on, so to speak. He's had plenty of offers over the years. There are many clubs at higher levels that have been very interested in him, right up to National League level. Actually, even Hoffenheim randomly once were very interested in him. I asked him, actually, you know, if Hoffenheim had been serious on their offer and taken you, would you have gone? And he said absolutely yes, because I mean, it's still his dream.
I blamed him for going to Hoffenheim.
Yeah, I mean, there's loyalty and then there's just stupidity if you stick around when Hoffenheim are offering you a contract, you know.
Yeah. So, but it's a lovely touch that he's been here all these years, and it's clear anytime you talk to him, he absolutely has the club at his heart. Big games, if they go our way, he's the most jubilant person you'll see. If they don't go our way, he absolutely wears his heart on his sleeve. And, you know, you'll often see him in tears just through pure emotion of not being able to do it for himself, for the team and for the fans. And that, as I said, that's an absolute special thing in football these days, and we cherish it.
Mm. Everything that Danny says, every answer he gives to your questions is just completely underlying underneath it all is this complete love of just playing. Like he just constantly talks about he loves diving around in the mud. That's one of his favourite things to say. He loves diving around in the mud, and that's why he's a keeper. I think this is perfectly encapsulated by the next clip we're going to hear, because this is when I asked him about his career. You know, Danny works in education, and I wanted to get a sense from him as to whether he could ever take a job that would interfere with his ability to play for the Corinthian Casuals, and this is what he had to say.
Yeah, no, I went to university and got a degree in sports coaching and joined the school just part-time because it fitted with my football. And yeah, gradually just done kind of every job going within the school. I've been a librarian, I've been a maths teacher, I've been a teaching assistant. Yeah, and then I kind of got qualified as a teacher and now I'm head of computing. So, you know, who knows where your life's going to end up, but it's a great job and it fits really well with football. I'm obviously available every Tuesday night. I'm available every Thursday night for training and obviously every Saturday for matches, which is kind of really important to me.
Yeah, I was just going to say, with each of those roles that you've taken on in the past, have you always had football in the back of your mind as a consideration, or even in the front of your mind? You know, I won't take this job if it in any way hinges on my ability to play football.
100%. I wouldn't do a job. I wouldn't do a job that stopped me playing football. So that's where I put it, even though I don't get paid and it's never ever going to put bread on the table for me. It's of that importance that I would never ever do a job that would stop me from playing football. Yeah, football is what I do. I think us being an amateur club says it all, the fact that everyone's on the same standing. So as everyone's giving up their time for free, everyone wants to turn up and wear the Casuals kit. Doesn't matter what race or religion or colour you are. If you put on that Casuals kit, you're one of us. And yeah, you need to be respected and being treated equally as everyone else in that changing room. That there's no outsiders, there's no one on the outside, everyone's together, and I think that's kind of shown in the last few years, the way we've kind of ground out results to stay in the league, that we're very much a tight-knit unit and everyone respects each other.
It's interesting to reflect on how every single player mentioned that there's a tight-knit unit in the dressing room, you know, that reflected in the coaching, on the pitch, and also the fans in the stands. You know, essentially it seems like they're saying that they stay here because it's a nice place to play football, which is all we can ask for, really, I think. We should also point out that the club has recently decided to start paying the players' expenses, travel expenses, so that they're not out of pocket, because we're now competing at a level we've never competed at before. We keep up purely because we're able to attract players to this club because of our history, because the manager's got great contacts, the assistant manager's got great contacts, because they want to stay once they come here. And we don't want those players to be out of pocket. So the club has actually started to pay travel expenses recently just to make sure that they're not at least paying to play for a team in the Isthmian Premier League.
Yeah, I feel like it's one thing to expect a former Crystal Palace player like Kieran Cadogan, who has played in the Championship, expecting him to play for free is feels ambitious. Expecting him to pay to play feels like it's perhaps going too far. But yeah, fascinating group of players to hear from today.
Yeah, and actually going back in time brings us on to the subject of next week's episode. What does it mean to be a Corinthian?
Yeah, so this is our final episode of the series. Yeah, what does it mean to be a Corinthian is a question that we've essentially posed to almost all of our interviewees, just to really see what the responses would be. We didn't want to sort of make it a leading question in any way. We didn't want to make it necessarily about the Corinthian values of old or indeed the modern day squad. We wanted people to answer how they saw fit. So yeah, you're going to hear a real range of different responses in next week's episode.
Brilliant.
So that was Current Crop. All that's left to do is to thank you, Stu, for your fine appearance today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Dom, once again.
Thank you.
And listeners, yeah, look out for episode 8, What Does It Mean to Be a Corinthian, dropping next week. In the meantime, we'll see you there. Next time on Broadway to Brazil.
The word Corinthian still stands for an ideal, a concept of perfect sportsmanship. Can you define exactly this Corinthian philosophy?
You know, the history of the club is something that we try and add to, but we'll never eclipse it. You know, we can never do that. But the people that are at the club, that's what makes a football club.
And I tell them, what are you talking about? We're an amateur club. And some of them don't even believe it. So I tell them, no, literally, we play for the love of football.
Corinthians Casos means a lot for Corinthians because it's our, like, younger brother, our father. Corinthians! Eu vivo por ti, Corinthians! Eu canto até ficar
rouco! Eu canto pra te empurrar e vamos, vamos! Broadway to Brazil is produced and presented by Yarick Zaba and Dominic Bliss, with editing by Yarick Zaba. Brent Davies is our audio engineer, and our title music is by John Forrest. Matt Alabuster did our artwork, and Chris Kelly manages the website. With additional thanks to Robin Hutchinson and the Community Brain and everyone at Corinthian Casuals Football Club. Broadway to Brazil is part of the Highway 61 network.
Follow Broadway to Brazil on Twitter at Broadway to Brazil with the number 2 in the middle. And remember, the Broadway to Brazil book is available now, telling the story of Series 1 with fabulous photos from Stuart Tree. You can buy the Broadway to Brazil book from any number of online retailers. Head to broadwaytobrazil.com for more info.